is the human baseline for driving what they should be trained on going forward? Because, I mean, if the robotaxi acts one way, Zoox acts another way, and Waymo's acting a third way, I mean, are we, like, they're expecting a human response from every other vehicle. They have a known response from other vehicles in their network. But then now you've got this whole other set of variables. Like, how do you even train against that?
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together the loveliest team of researchers, product leaders, and deep thinkers to distill down and navigate the high-speed and ever more complex landscape of artificial intelligence. Today, I'm joined by Gabe Goodhart, Chief Architect, AI Open Innovation, Kauter L. Magrawi, Principal Research Scientist and Manager for Hybrid Cloud Platform, and joining us for the very first time is Anne Funai, CIO and VP for Business Platform Transformation. We have an action-packed episode today, but first, let's talk about your brain on ChatGPT. So I really want to cover this really interesting paper that came out of MIT. A number of researchers published a paper that's literally called Your Brain on ChatGPT. And it's a pretty fun paper, but first, I kind of want to start with our round-the-horn question, which is simply, do you feel smarter or dumber in the age of LLMs? Gabe, maybe I'll start with you. How do you feel about this?
Sure. If I'm doing something I already feel smart at, like writing code, I feel smarter. It's awesome. If I'm doing something I feel really dumb at, like writing for other people to read, I feel actually a lot dumber because I don't actually comprehend what I'm getting.
That's a great answer. Anne, what do you think?
I almost feel like it's a neutral, like it's a validation of maybe some of my insecurities. So I know I'm terrible, like words are hard at that. And the LLMs, like the AIs, like they write the emails. I am terrible at writing. I almost feel like, so I have this validation of things I'm like not smart at, but also it frees up brain space for the stuff that I am intrigued by. And it, you know, that I do enjoy pursuing. So
that's great. We have such a nuanced panel. I was just like, people were going to be like smarter, dumber. But Kauter, what do you think? How do you feel about all this?
Yeah, I don't think I feel anything here. But maybe the question here isn't whether LLM make us smarter or dumber, but whether we choose to engage with them in ways that sharpen or soften our minds. So it's like really how you engage with these LLMs.
Well, we'll get into all of this in this discussion. So let me just kind of set up the paper a little bit. Would love kind of your all's responses. So this is a fun paper. They're basically using brain scanning technology. And what they did is they kind of divided their research participants into a couple of cohorts. And they said, okay, we're going to have you all do a series of tasks where you write an essay. And then for the people who basically like used LLMs to do this, they have a cohort they call LLM to brain, where they say, okay, and on this next task, what you're going to have to do is write the essay just by hand, right, with no AI assistance. And kind of what they claim is, and I'll just quote them directly, LLM to brain participants showed weaker neural connectivity and under-engagement of alpha and beta networks. So to put that kind of in more human-readable language, the idea is their brains were actually less active while they were accomplishing this task, shifting from an LLM-based assistive kind of scenario to one where they had to do it all by themselves. And so I guess, Anne, I know you're on the show for the first time. Maybe I'll turn it to you for your hot take. Is like, how much do we take from this? Is like, I mean, I know there are a lot of hot takes on the internet that were like, it's killing our minds, but do you read it that way?
So, you know, it's actually, I'll have to say I'm not surprised by the take because I would say, I think the world is trying to figure out how to use AI in the best and most advantageous way possible. But what it reminded me of is I almost feel like it's like cycles of human computer evolution. Like when tablets and phones became ubiquitous, it's like, oh, it's killing our mind. I can look everything up instantaneously. And like, I mean, if you even go way back, like if you think, you know, historians with books, it's like, I rue the world for the next generation. They're going to ruin it. And like, you know, it's like, I mean, you can go back through like, you know, Renaissance authors, like in reading that. And it's like, I kind of almost put that in the context of like, yeah, so yes, real science behind it with the brain activity, but is this just another like, I rule the world for AI is going to make us all dumber? And at the end of the day, it is what we make of it. Like, we can take the I don't know, maybe this is too much of a Gen X reference. We can take the Idiocracy take that we're all going to allow ourselves.
I get that reference.
Yeah. It's like we can take the Idiocracy take. We're just going to get stupider and just let it become our brains. But I'm stealing an analogy someone else used. Like, but if we become like Tony Stark with the Iron Man suit on and let it, you know, be an amplification of our brain power and an education tool, that's goodness, right? That is real, real goodness, and actually should be pushing our brain power further, I think, if we use it properly.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was joking with a friend when I read this paper. I was like, you imagine the first person to invent a book, and they're basically like, oh, well, people don't have to memorize anything anymore. You know, it's like so bad for us to have all these books.
And it's funny, we just, under the CFO, a leadership team of us went through the IBM archives, and they were showing the original like accounting books are on at the IBM archives. And it's like, well, our accountants, boy, that's a hard set of words to say. Are our accountants dumber because they have spreadsheets now or technology? And the answer is no. I think it's detail, nuance. You know, you can really dig into problems in a different way.
Yeah, for sure. Gabe, I want to bring you into this conversation because I think you had such an interesting response to the kind of hot take round the horn question, where I was like, I'm hoping my hope was that people would be like, oh, I feel dumber or I feel smarter. But I think, Gabe, you were like, it depends on what tasks. Like for things I'm good at, I feel more engaged. I think what you said was if for tasks I feel less good at, then I feel differently. How do you think that kind of applies to some of the results here?
Yeah. So I definitely teased it in that, but that was really my read of this is that the one thing you didn't mention in the intro is they kind of did the inverse as well as the LLM to brain. They did the brain to LLM, and that the brain to LLM group actually showed really good engagement. And I think the way I have found myself using LLMs is primarily as a coding assistant, but where I am completely in control of the code. And what I use for them is to accelerate my ability to explore an area that I don't have prepped and ready to go. In that context, I am still very actively engaged in the act of creation. And that's a brain space in which my intelligence is moving fast.
The brain's like firing.
Exactly. So if the LLM can like remove a time that my brain had to swap out and go figure out the right Google search, like that keeps my brain in the hot zone longer and better, and it builds faster. So in that case, I feel way smarter. Where I feel like it makes me dumber is when I'm trying to get it to replace something that I don't like to do and I'm not very good at doing to begin with. So I occasionally write blog articles. And if I get in the right zen, I can actually sit down and write, you know, expository writing. But it's not my sweet spot. And so I could try to come up with a prompt, slam it at an LLM, get some text out and skim it more in consumer mode and critic mode rather than creator mode. My brain never hits that hot zone. I never hit that place where I'm actually really thinking and framing and coming up with the right connections for it. And in that case, the thing I get at the end, yes, it took me a fraction of the time it would have taken me to get it in the first place, but I don't feel the same sort of ownership and the same level of deep engagement with what I just created. And I think in that context, so I think that's one thing that I found really interesting about this study was sort of that difference between these two different ways of stimulating. Either you're already deep in with your brain and you're using the LLM to boost it, or you're just starting with the LLM doing it for you, and then you're trying to apply your brain to what the LLM already did. And I think those are a really different way of using LLMs.
Yeah, I'd love to bring these two comments together and Kautar kind of bring you into this conversation. You know, I'm old enough to remember like the discourse around like graphing calculators, right? And it was basically like, I remember the teacher always being like, well, it's important to understand how you do, I don't know, like a graph a function. Before you do it automatically on your calculator. And I think, Gabe, what you're pointing out is that's right, is basically it's the brain to LLM versus LLM to brain. And so I guess, Kautar, I know you said, like, you kind of don't feel anyway about this, but wondering, like, you know, how new is this in some sense? Like, do you think this is just, like, now LLMs kind of repeating, I guess, what we've kind of maybe already gone through with stuff like, I don't know, say, like a graphing calculator or something like that?
Yeah, actually, I like to think it's also as, you know, this parallel, like kind of mirroring the historical effects of the industrial automation. You know, as machines relieved humans of physical labor, physical strength and endurance kind of declined for the majority of us. And unless you really, you know, work really hard, you know, those muscles and exercise and things like that, you know, if you look at the majority of the people back then, most of us, you know, most of the people were stronger because they had to do a lot of physical labor. But as we had now, we rely on more cars and on, you know, these machineries, to clean our houses, to do these things, our muscle evolved to be weaker. And I worry a little bit, you know, are we, you know, getting into this cognitive automation risks or a similar atrophy here, not for our muscles, but for our minds? You know, just as cars made us walk less, AI systems could make us think less deeply. So we're not just outsourcing tasks, we're externalizing cognition. And I think that's what this paper is, kind of a crucial wake-up call here regarding the end critical adoption of these AI tools for complex cognitive tasks. So I think it depends how you engage. You know, when I said, you know, how you engage with these tools, so are you going to, you know, over-rely on them for these deep thinking without really engaging your brains? Or you want to use them, like Gabe mentioned, as, you know, to augment you for tasks that you're really good. So I think it depends. And I think here, you know, if you're looking, the concept of this cognitive depth also that, you know, mentioned here is, you know, particularly compelling, suggesting that, you know, this subtle but profound long-term impact on how our brain functions. So I think for individuals, you know, especially in education or professional settings, I find the takeaway isn't, you know, to abandon AI, but to cultivate, you know, this cognitive resilience. So meaning, you know, using AI strategically for brainstorming, fact-checking, summarizing, boosting your performance, but consciously engaging in, you know, deep thinking, analysis, or original synthesis ourselves. So it's more about, you know, how do you treat these AI tools to augment, not to replace our fundamental cognitive process. So it's like, how do we find that critical balance?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, and maybe I'll kick it to you because we could go much longer and I need to move us on to our other stories. But I mean, responding to kind of what Kautar is saying, is there a view here, like just to play skeptic for a moment, it's like, well, it's all well and good to tell people that they need to, you know, use their critical faculties with this technology. But like, people are lazy, right? Like, we can't expect people to do that. Yeah. And so like, I don't know, I think like, is it hoping against hope that people are going to kind of like use this technology in a way that looks a little bit more like brain to LLM versus LLM to brain?
Exactly. And my hope would be the brain to LLM, you know, the comment I made about, you know, it's how we learn to use it. My hope is that we shift to that. And I absolutely agree with the humans are lazy. You know, again, myself included, I use the examples like read my email, like I'll put the words, make it usable. But, you know, like you, I joke that I'm an optimist, but I'm a cynical optimist because I could see every way it could go wrong before you actually get to the most optimistic outcome. And I mean, where I would put my hope and optimism in this case is, you know, at the end of the day, we're still human beings that have things that interest us and drive us. So, you know, I will go read technology papers, I'll play with things, toys, whatever, you know, and that's always going to be what drives me. And an AI is actually going to help me go further and deeper, I think, in that. And, you know, it could be the same with someone who's a doctor, a lawyer, like, I don't know, maybe retail shopping changes and marketing. Like, my hope and optimism would be that makes you lazy in the tasks that don't drive the things that interest you.
Right. It's optimally lazy.
Yeah, it's optimally. Yeah. I love that. That's perfect. Optimally lazy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Well, much more to talk about. We'll be paying attention to this story. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to come on this kind of research. But I want to move us to our next topic. Super interesting story came out of the SF Chronicle. It's kind of like a local metro paper in San Francisco. And in San Francisco, I don't know if this is, some of our listeners will be in cities where, you know, these robo-taxis are rolling out. Autonomous driving is a thing, right? You can just call a robo-taxi, it'll take you to your location. And these are all run by Waymo right now, which is a part of the kind of Alphabet, Google kind of network of companies. And the article is really fascinating because it focuses on the idea that now that they've seen such great success with the Waymos, the Waymos are now actively driving a little bit more aggressively. And one of the great examples they give is that now, you know, the Waymos will do this like little rolling start, you know, when it's about to go through an intersection. And like much like a human would, you kind of like loosen up on the brake and it's kind of a signal to the rest of the road, like I'm getting in here. And I think this is like so fascinating. And at least what the Waymo folks say in the article is that like it turns out that having a robotaxi that's like a lot more brisk and a lot more decisive and like, dare I say it, kind of like a jerk a little bit on the road actually makes things safer. Which I think is just like such a funny sort of outcome. And so, Kautar, would love to bring you in on this. Is like, how should we think about this? Because normally I think in the chatbot world, we've tended to make our AIs like very, you know, like very catering. But this is almost like an example, I think, where it turns out that we're getting better results from having AIs that are like much more assertive when they interact with humans. And so I'm just curious if you have any hot takes about that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I found really fascinating how Waymo is now prioritizing human-like driving behavior to better integrate into real-world or urban environments. So I think what this is saying is safety doesn't just mean rule following and being very strict with these rules. It also means fitting into a human-centered system and overly cautious, you know, automatic, you know, driving machines or AVs can be disruptive as, you know, what they've seen on the roads. So this shift, it kind of reflects this delicate trade-off between, you know, algorithmic perfection, but also social compatibility. So it seems like we're entering this uncanny valley of behaviors, cars that are smart enough to mimic our bad habits. And what does it say here when AI becomes more trustworthy by being less perfect? So it's very interesting kind of paradox here that we need less perfection here to really fit, you know, these social norms. And that kind of translates into safer systems because, you know, these cars have to act in human environments. So they have kind of to adapt how we're being. So, and this is kind of also critical, you know, highlighting here a critical challenge in designing these AI systems, especially for the future, that operate in complex and predictable real-world environments. So how human-like should they be? And that's the key question here. So, and I think what Waymo's approach here is suggesting that really strict adherence to rules might not be the safest. And that is very interesting.
Gabe, so I lived in San Francisco for many years and then spent about a few years in LA. And I remember when I moved to LA, I was like, these drivers are unhinged. Like basically like the culture of driving is just like aggressive in a way that is like not very familiar having driven around San Francisco for like, you know, close to a decade. I guess one of the interesting questions in building off of what Kautar just said is that it kind of suggests that for some of these systems, we're almost going to have to like localize them to cultural practices. Like, is that the right way of thinking about it? It's like very different from how we think about rolling out these systems typically, I think.
Well, the analogy that immediately jumped to my mind reading this article was the shift from pre-Gen AI chatbots to Gen AI chatbots. If you think about how we built chatbots before Transformers, we built them by crafting a very deep decision tree and trying to figure out at every point in that tree where the person was trying to go down that tree and then taking them down the right leg of it. And if any of you, all of us, I'm sure, have all walked through one of those trees on the phone or on a chat on somebody's customer assistance, and it's really clunky. It's like, I'm trying to reverse engineer the tree in my head. I'm trying to figure out, okay, I know I'm on the wrong branch. I want to move up a node and get back down this other one. And it's maddening, right? And I think a rules-based vehicle is very analogous, right? It's really trying to make sure it's following exactly the right structured path in its trajectory of possible actions at every given point in time. And I would love to unbox what Waymo is doing here, because my guess, frankly, is that they're starting to apply a much more free-form decision-making space akin to generate me the next token, generate me the next thing that needs to happen. So I wouldn't be surprised if they've got a reinforcement learning transformer sitting on top of whatever their rules system is now that's actually got a much wider space of possible next actions, and they're generating the stuff on the fly. So to me, when you say localized to different geos, that's a different system prompt, right? Like, it's basically, I need to basically, you know, zero shot learn my car with a whole bunch of examples of the crazy LA drivers, right? So in some ways too, if we start applying this more flexible way of adapting the behavior to the environment, it may actually, you know, just as the article suggested, make the vehicle fit in a whole lot better. And I think, honestly, that's one of the things, going back to that analogy to chatbots, that really powered the Gen AI explosion, is that all of a sudden the consumption experience jumped over that uncanny valley that you mentioned, Kautar, that said, you know, now I feel like I'm talking to a real entity on the other end. I'm not reverse engineering in my head. I feel comfortable in this space in exactly the same way that drivers would now feel comfortable in a space where they're mixed other humans and autonomous vehicles because those autonomous vehicles fit their mental perception.
Yeah, I love the idea that somewhere hidden in like Waymo's cloud, there's a prompt that's like, you're a San Francisco driver.
Exactly,
you
right?
You know, 25 to 35, and like you live in the Mission District of San Francisco. Like, and I think, do you want to take us on like a little bit of a journey into like where this all goes in some sense? Because I think like what's really fun about this is like, this is a multi-round game now, right? Imagine a future where there's multiple car companies operating autonomous vehicles. And like one of them's like, I can actually get my consumers to the location faster if my car's like a little bit of a jerk. And so I'm really interested in kind of thinking about like how this evolves, but I'll just kind of give you that prompt. I'm curious.
And it's actually funny, and this was not planned at all. We can attest. Mm-hmm. That's actually exactly where my head went to.
Great.
And as an aside, by the way, I'm in Austin, Texas, and the San Francisco LA analogy is Austin and Houston. Like Houston is like, Houston is a whole other game, entire social media feeds associated to ridiculous Houston driving. But it is funny you targeted me that way, because what we have going in Austin is interesting. We have Waymo, we have Zoox, and we now, as of this week, have the Tesla robo-taxis. So I read this, the irony is right before we, you know, got this article to look at to discuss, I was coming back from a trip to the airport. My partner and I are in the car, and he's like, we're both like commenting and looking, that Waymo is driving like a maniac. Like it was like, it was actually going above the speed limit. It was doing a little bit of zoom.
Oh,
and
we're no.
like, well, it was actually a little bit like, ooh, maybe I won't.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not there yet. But it kind of, and he's a tech person too. So it kind of led us into this weird conversation of like, okay, where's this going? What's doing? Then how is that learning? And then saw this article and I thought like, gosh, what happens? Because as there are more of the autonomous vehicles on the road, they are trained on human behavior, not the behavior of each other. And there was actually another piece I had seen right around the same time. I think it was a New York Times article talking about how the evolution of Waymo, that in the first 6 months of 2025, they've already done double the rides they did in all of 2024. And I think 2024 was 5x 2023, which obviously due to expansion in part, but it's like, I don't know, it really got me thinking, is like, is the human baseline for driving what they should be trained on going forward? Because, I mean, if the robo-taxi acts one way, Zoox acts another way, and Waymo's acting a third way, I mean, are we, like, they're expecting a human response from every other vehicle. They have a known response from other vehicles in their network.
Right. You know.
But then now you've got this whole other set of variables. Like, how do you even train against that? Because let's be honest, they're all going to have proprietary, they're all going to learn, they're all going to have a proprietary way of doing it. So I think it's, I actually think in 5 years, that 5 years or less, maybe, I guess, looking at how fast this is taking off.
Yeah, it's doubling, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be very, very important to adapt, you know, like how do these, you know, train models adapt, you know, on the fly, and especially as maybe we need more tiny models or more capable models, you know, local on device, you know, that they can, you know, make decisions and, you know, retrain, fine tune and things, you know, on the fly in real time, especially, you know, the driving will change depending, like you said, you know, in San Francisco, if I go to Morocco, for example, the driving is way different, much more aggressive, you know.
Yeah, you would win aggressive in Morocco for sure.
Oh my God. You know, I can't drive there myself. So I can imagine like a trained, you know, car here in the U.S., you know, putting that in Morocco, you know, it needs to adapt completely, you know, different, much more aggressive behavior. So I think we need more of that going forward, you know, so we just don't rely on these statically trained models, but these models have to adapt constantly.
I could even see what could be interesting is like a lot of open source consortiums have started because of similar problems like this. Is like we want to have, you know, you want to have your proprietary piece as a company, but you recognize there's an area where you have to have common understanding, common knowledge, common engagement. Like maybe it is that, okay, we admit we're going to like go to use an open source piece that is how we train in the same way so we're not all crashing into each other. But then they put proprietary pieces on top of that for their business model.
Yeah, I think the handshake will be very interesting because, yeah, think about different brands of autonomous vehicle. You know, it's like your car's computer vision model is like, oh, but that's a Tesla robo. You know, like we got to, you know, navigate around it in a way that's different from a Waymo. And I feel like the easier way is if there's just some technical handshake that says, hey, you know, I'm just signaling to everybody on the road that I'm from this company and have these attributes. So that'll be very, very interesting to see. Well, great. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. I am, by admission, not really a sports guy, but I was roped into watching the NBA finals, which were great. I think I'm now a basketball guy. I caught this really interesting ad that it turns out was like widely talked about in the ad industry. There's a prediction market company called Kalshi. And they did this completely surreal, mind-bending ad that played during game 3 of the NBA finals. A lot of crazy scenes. And I remember looking at it and being like, this really looks like Gen AI. And lo and behold, it came out later that, of course, this is like a Gen AI ad. And I think it's one of the most high-profile end-to-end Gen AI ads that we've really kind of seen happen in the media. And I wanted to bring it up because in the past, I think we've thought often about generated AI or generative AI for ads as kind of something that we see for like, you know, kind of like more bargain bin ad inventory, right? Like the kinds of things you encounter online. But this is like high prestige, often what marketing people call like brand advertising. It's like, this is like, you know, an ad that you'd see in the New York Times, right? It's like a little bit like that. I guess, Gabe, maybe I'll bring you in. I'm kind of curious about like how we should sort of read this, that like basically almost like the use of these technologies is so good now that, you know, a big company like Kalshi will say, we're going to spend a huge amount of money and then like use this technology to generate an ad for this really high profile event. It's a signal of some kind, I think, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think I have three different reactions to it.
sure. We need all the hot takes. Bring them.
One on the technical front, one sure. on the consumer front, and then one on the skeptic front. So I think on the technical front, one thing that I thought was really compelling was that I watched the ad, and there were very few of what you might expect from the Gen AI sort of blemishes. Now, they did a good job of making it a fast-paced ad, so your eye isn't going to pick up on the fact that one random person in the crowd has six fingers or something like that. But, you know, they did a really, you know, the actual quality of what was generated was really good. And I think, you know, that merged with some clever expertise of how to cut the ad together, you know, really produced a good-looking ad. It didn't smack of, you know, some duct tape here to hide all the gorp, right? From a consumer standpoint, you know, like, it's a good ad. And if it, you know, lowered the denominator for the cost of creating it for the company making it, cool. That sounds like a, you know, a good optimization for, you know, the industry, for the world. I think my biggest take, though, is on the skeptic and the worrier front, which is... who were those humans in the video? Now, obviously, they were not recorded humans, but we all know that Gen AI models are based on a whole boatload of training data. So as this becomes more ubiquitous, what are the odds that somebody's face who did not give their permission to be in an advertisement for it, Company X, shows up on screen with absolutely no way of validating whether that's happening or not, right? It's a huge gulf between whatever training data went into the model and the actual faces and images and body representations and all of that that pops out on the screen. And, you know, right now it's a needle in a haystack, right? Like, do you think anyone in the background scenes of any of those are going to happen to be people that watch it and say, hey, wait a minute, that's me. I'm going to sue your pants off. No. But as the number of ads that are created with Gen AI balloon, it's going to happen, right? The odds are going to shake out that somebody is going to suddenly realize that their face is popping up in ads that they have nothing to do with and they're getting no compensation for. So it's a different but related element to the copyright issues around authors' books, you know, snippets popping up if they're sufficiently popular. It's I think, going to go down that same rabbit hole of ownership of likeness, ownership of content, where the content in this case is your actual, you know, persona in visual space.
Yeah. And maybe I'll turn to you. I think you're raising, Gabe, a really good point. And I think one of the things I really want to investigate is like how mainstream this becomes, right? Like, how much of this is kind of a one-off novelty? Everybody's like surprised that AI can do this. But like, I have a friend who's in the ad industry. He was like, I just don't think it's a very good ad, you know? But then I think on top of that, like, you layer on everything, Gabe, that you're talking about, which is, well, there's also all these other risks that come with using this technology. Do people want to take on that risk when they do these kind of ads? I guess, and to kind of like put it in like a sharper term, it's like, you know, in 3 or 4 years, do we feel like every ad for game 3 of the NBA finals is going to be AI generated? Like, how far do you think this is going
to
go?
Yeah, no. And before I answer, plus one to everything Gabe said. I mean, there's so many things that can go in any direction there. But you know, what I kind of went back to when looking through that article was, you know, at the end of the day, marketing is still a data-driven exercise, right? Like to be a marketer, it's data-driven. And it's not so much about, are we going to have more AI ads, but what are the outcomes businesses are kind of trying to drive through an advertisement, right? And is it just awareness? Like you feel like, people haven't been paying attention to us. Our awareness is going down. Our revenues are dropping. We need to do something flashy that just gets our name out there and gets people looking at us again. Or like, are we trying to, you know, sell a specific product? But again, it goes back to like, what is your goal with the ad and that outcome you're kind of trying to drive? So I think I would say that's where there's a little, you know, TBD on there. But at the same vein, like, let's go back to maybe that first conversation about brain to LLM, LLM to brain. You may have a clear outcome you're trying to drive, a clear vision of what you're trying to do, but the AI may be able to create the advertisement faster and better than a human could, which is, you know, I would say that's the brain to LLM versus the LLM to brain diminishment we were talking about before. So again, I would lean on, you know, marketing is always going to be outcome driven. It's going to be a flashy thing. But I think if, again, the direction of the flashy thing used for the right purpose, I think could get really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's right. Kautar, I think one final bit I think you'd be well positioned to talk a little bit about is, you know, I think in the past when I've heard this discussion about AI generated ads, it's been very much like, in the future, everybody's going to have their own custom ad, right? We can use generative AI to basically create like your favorite movie star telling you you should use Kalshi or whatever as a service. This is kind of an interesting place where actually generative AI is being used for everybody to see the same ad. Curious if you want to kind of talk a little bit about that. Like, do you think, you know, it's more likely that people will want the ultra targeted stuff, which is a little bit building on the theme that Anne was talking a little bit about? Or, you know, is there something really fundamental to advertising, which is no matter how it's created, we still kind of want it to be like a shared culture in some ways? Like, I think about those Super Bowl ads that, like, you know, became kind of cultural movements in their own right. It sounds like, you know, maybe this is actually kind of even preserved in a world of generative AI.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Of course, I think personalization, I think, is an important aspect here. Some people would like that. Some people don't, because they want to like the shared kind of advertising to see what everybody's seeing. So it's interesting to see. And I think in the world of generative AI, it's really possible because there is so much data that they're collecting on each one of us. So, you know, if they can generate, you know, this generic ad, they can might as well generate these personalized ads based on, your historical preferences and data, what you've purchased and things like that. So I think we will see both of those. And just interesting, just looking, you know, when I was looking at this new ad and the statistics behind this, so like they had like this 300 to 400 generated results around 15 usable clicks. You know, the cost was $2,000, which is about 95% cheaper than traditional production. And they reached, you know, it took two to four days using one creator for the full ad. And an estimate of like 18 million views. That is really huge, you know, in about 48 hours. So what is this telling us? You know, of course, more of these marketers and companies will use these tools to create these ads. But what's the implications of this? I think if we really think about this more deeply, AI here isn't replacing the creatives. It's also fragmenting this creativity task stack. And so the bottleneck is no longer in the production, but more in the ideation and the originality of the ad. So, I mean, yes, we can generate all of these things, like, you know, like Gabe mentioned, maybe faces, you know, that are, you know, randomly will be picked up that could be any one of us. And so how creative these ads are. So I think what Kalashi here is highlighting is both the promise and also the peril. So democratizing content, you know, creation here at an industrial speed, but also the risk of having these homogenized, hyper-targeted media. And we could be like soon flooded with, you know, highly personalized ad, but are they going to move us? Are we going to find them creative, or like the why factor, is it going to be there? So that is the key question here. Can generative AI do that? Or maybe we need, you know, some additional things that we have to bring to the table with human creativity that's really going to make it or break it for the viewers.
Yeah, I hope they get it right. I mean, I think otherwise it's a pretty dark future of like just being flooded with like very slap ads that you just don't like.
That's become so boring.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. I want to end with two special notes. Anne, I know this is the first time on the show. If people want to find you, keep up with your work, where should they go?
So fun enough, if you enjoy podcasts, we've started a podcast called Transformers. And, you know, our goal really is to show people across industries and technical. We're expanding this season to non-technical roles. Really what it takes to transform, you know, a company, a business, you know, open source, closed source, fintech, you know, fintech, tech tech. So, you know, come find me over there. It's we have a lot of fun with a lot of really interesting guests from a lot of really fun places. And hopefully conversation is entertaining as this.
Yeah, for sure. It's really good. You should subscribe, listeners. And then finally, I want to take a personal moment to thank producers Hans Buto, Mike Brugnetta, and Michael Simonelli. They've basically been fearlessly working behind the scenes essentially ever since MOE got started like a year ago. And so we owe essentially a huge amount of the success of this show to them, and we will miss you guys. This is their last show that they are working on with us here at MOE. So we will miss you guys. Thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you next week on Mixture of Experts.